A podcast of the cinema
starring
Dave White.
That's me.
Film critic for The Wrap.
Also
me, Alonso Duralde.
Who are you? What do you do?
I do stuff. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap. I'm co-host of the Who Shot You podcast at Maximum Fun, and of What the Flick, that's soon going to be something else. And don't ask me when, it's going to be very soon. And author of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, which is what I've been talking about all week.
Are you yet exhausted with talking about Christmas movies to all the people who want you to come on their podcasts and radio programs to talk about Christmas movies? You made your bed.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Like, and of course, like,
out of candy canes.
As though this weren't already like the busy month for film critics.
That's right.
You know, I got to get caught up on stuff before LA Film Critics votes next weekend and then write my top 10 list and blah, blah, blah.
Somebody decided.
But oh no.
He was going to be El Mero Mero de Navidad.
Yeah, yeah. I made my bed in Santa's workshop and now I have to sleep in it. But no, it's been great, actually. I do enjoy talking about Christmas movies and I've gotten to do it in a bunch of places, most notably at the moment when this drops. You can go listen to the latest episode, or not the latest, but one of the latest episodes.
A very recent episode of
Deck the Hallmark.
Yes.
A very funny podcast you should be listening to anyway. Even if you can't stand and never watch Hallmark movies, the guys who host this show are very funny. And the whole premise is that one of them loves them, one of them likes them, and one of them hates them.
Them meaning
Hallmark movies.
Garbage Hallmark movies.
So I went on to talk about A Shoe Addict's Christmas, starring Ms., or I guess she would prefer Mrs. Candace Cameron Bure. So go check that out.
What did you make me do?
Hey, Dave.
With regard to A Shoe Melon Farming Addict's Christmas.
I said, would you please watch A Shoe Addict's Christmas with me to make sure that I had plenty of fun things to say on Deck the Hallmark and I didn't miss things?
I don't ever want to hear anyone in my life question my loyalty and love for you, my spouse.
It's true.
Because that you ask me to do this stuff, and then I do it.
That was an above and beyond
because
moment
Give me them puppy eyes. You're like, will you please?
Look, I watch. I will watch all the other 36 Hallmark movies after you are safely in bed, but I needed your help on this one.
Can't drag you out to a theater to see, you know, difficult.
You took me to Hale County this morning, this evening.
I sure did.
So
your life was better.
That
for
was
it.
My shoe addict's Christmas for you.
Don't eat. Do not.
I knew you'd love that.
Don't. Could you not?
They are not comparable, but nonetheless,
indeed.
No, this is not a one-way street. I give.
All right.
Kind of a light week.
Well, it's good because we're lightweights.
Yeah. And apologies. I meant to catch up on some things, but because I've been doing all these podcast interviews, I have not had the time that I would have liked to have watched Mirai, which is a Japanese animated film that is open this weekend that I'm hearing wonderful things about.
Yes.
Nor have I had a chance to watch Happy as Lazaro on Netflix, which won the Screenplay Award at Cannes this year and has just now premiered on Netflix. And most likely, this is the first time you've ever heard of this movie, because sometimes Netflix acquires things and then just kind of, you know,
here they are,
relies on some word of mouth, if that. It probably isn't popping up, you know, with the making you watch the trailer when you turn on Netflix.
What country is it from?
I want to say Germany.
Germany.
Alice Rohrwacher. Rohrwacher is the director, but like I think Scorsese's an executive producer or something. Okay. So anyway, haven't seen it yet. Hearing great things. We'll get caught up and we'll talk about it on a future episode.
It's the cozy time of year for sitting on the couch and watching all of the Academy screeners that get sent to this home.
Yes.
There are four sizable stacks of them on the shelf. I'm looking at them right now.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, we're not going to get through all of those.
No. And luckily, a lot of those are movies we've already seen. Correct. But, you know, yeah. This is the week to start prioritizing because Sunday, like I said, LA Film Critics votes. And so I got to, like, figure out what I got to see.
But we're only reviewing two films this week.
That's true.
Two.
Yeah. This might be a short episode.
But first, let's begin. There's some news.
Yes, I guess there is.
There have been two...
big deaths.
Internationally known filmmakers pass away this week.
Yes.
One of them is Nicholas Roeg.
Yes. Nicholas Roeg, who started out as a cinematographer on some really important films of the 60s, like Richard Lester's Petulia and François Truffaut's Fahrenheit 451.
Yep.
And then went into directing and really... carved out, I'd say, a unique space for himself. Like, he's the kind of director like David Lynch where his last name becomes an adjective.
Yeah.
Because he's doing something very, you know, particular and special that other filmmakers aren't. There's a dreamlike sensibility to his films. There's a challenge to what we consider mainstream narrative. Sometimes operating within genre, sometimes not. But, like, you know, you look at Walkabout or The Man Who Fell to Earth, Don't Look Now.
Right.
I'm a big fan of
Performance.
Performance, which he co-directed. I'm a big fan of Insignificance, which I don't know if it's held in as high a regard as some of his other films, but I've always just kind of personally dug it, starring his then-wife, Teresa Russell, as Marilyn Monroe, who has a memorable encounter with Albert Einstein, and also crossing paths with Joe DiMaggio and Joe McCarthy. And then, of course, I think for a lot of younger listeners, they will know him as the director of The Witches.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting choice because, you know, it was a collaboration between Roeg and the Jim Henson Company. And, yeah. And, yeah. And,
strangely enough.
Yeah, and good on Henson for thinking, that's some outside-the-box hiring there, you know. But it's a great movie, and I think, again, I think probably a movie that Roald Dahl had problems with because they changed the ending of the book. But, you know, whatever. I'm fine with it. It's not my problem. I think it's a terrific movie. So Roeg is really, you know, just a challenging filmmaker and very much of that period in the 70s and 80s where people were willing to take ideas that might have heretofore been part of experimental cinema and make them part of the mainstream.
Yeah. He made art house films that wound up at the local theater.
Yeah.
And there was just that weird moment in history where audiences
would take a chance on that stuff.
I guess we'll go see that.
Yeah.
And they probably walked out of it, went home and were like, we did not like that. But
well, you know, Paul,
but it was part of the world.
Paul Schrader, who's been saying things of late.
Hey, listen, here's the thing about Paul Schrader. He gets in his feelings and gets on Twitter and needs to stop doing that. Paul Schrader is a great filmmaker.
He is.
Who
first Reformed, one of this year's best films.
Might need
Winter Mitchell Rohrbach, yes.
To help him with his social media presence.
That's a very good idea.
Because I think he handles it himself.
I bet you he does.
I think he does. And says indefensible things about how he wishes he could hire Kevin Spacey for a film. And I'm like, there are other actors.
Anyway, Paul Schrader also this week made a comment about how the reason that movies aren't as good anymore is not because the filmmakers aren't, it's because the audiences aren't.
Well, he's right about that.
And yeah, I mean, as much as on the one hand you're like, that smacks a bit of like, you know, get off my lawn, he has a point. I mean, I think that...
Do indeed get off my lawn.
I think there was a period where there was an audience in this country that made like Ingmar Bergman and François Truffaut and Fellini and Godard and Akira Kurosawa kind of household names.
Yeah, the baby boomers who then went on to break all of their promises.
I guess.
Yes.
But actually, actually, this is before the boomers, though, because think about it. Like, the French New Wave was happening when the boomers were still, like, in junior high.
Okay, you're right. You're right.
I think
they came along in the late 60s, early 70s, and they became the film-going audience.
This is true. Yeah. But I think there was sort of a...
And the mainstreaming of that stuff happened in the late 60s, early
70s. This is true, yes. Okay. I mean, the new Hollywood is very much obviously a 70s thing. But again, that was a reflection of those earlier folks. And I think there's an interesting conversation to be had about the general dumbing down of all the arts, you know, and all the media,
right.
You know, I think that the post-World War II generation, the G.I. Bill generation, sought a certain level of, like, cultural, involvement. You know, the Book of the Month Club and, like, operas on television.
Yes,
like,
there was this, about this before,
idea of culture that you're supposed to be keeping up with.
Oh, my God, how do I wish there was an opera channel or even a streaming opera app that you could get on the Apple TV? Is there one? No. Not that I know of.
If you know of one.
If anyone knows of one.
We're at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Dave White wants to subscribe.
Why am I living in the future without this thing that I want?
I mean, I bet there's opera on YouTube.
There is.
Okay.
You can see complete operas on YouTube.
Yeah. But anyway.
That ain't enough for me.
So I think that Schrader is right in that, like, movie audiences became less demanding and less interested in... You know, I mean, like, who are the foreign brand names right now? Like, Almodovar, maybe Bong Joon-ho, but not a lot of them. Not in the way there used to be as far as, like, people going out to see a subtitled movie.
Lars von Trier, sometimes. That's the time. Now you're asking me that. You know, top of my head.
Anyway, when these kind of movies were more par for the course, or not par for the course, but at least had an audience and were
when
part of...
Fellini was at the multiplex
in
the 1970s.
Exactly.
That happened.
Right, yeah. When these filmmakers were part of the conversation, Nicholas Roeg was, you know, like, making things happen.
When Bernardo Bertolucci was in the multiplex.
Also
in the 1970s. He also died this week.
Yes.
He was the director of The Conformist and...
He won an Oscar for The Last Emperor.
And Last Tango in Paris, and 1900, and The Sheltering Sky.
The Dreamers.
He's also the guy who played a cruel trick.
Yes.
On an actress.
Maria a young Schneider. Actress.
Young actress, Maria Schneider, in Last Tango in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
He and Marlon Brando planned a sex scene that was not in the script, and they did not tell her until the last moment, and bullied her into doing the scene.
Yeah.
After the scene was over, she felt humiliated, and in her words, here's the quote, a little raped. Obviously, the sex scene was simulated sex.
Yes.
Nevertheless, I believe... that it counts as assault.
Yeah.
And I think many people agree with that position.
Yes.
And I've had discussions with friends this week. Some who care about film, some who just actually don't care all that much about film.
Mm-hmm.
But who care about justice.
Sure.
And... I'm not torn, but I am also, because I know what I think.
Yeah.
I think that in spite of the fact that The Conformist is a work of art and 1900 is a great film, I don't need to go to bat for Bertolucci. Mostly because I'm not the lawgiver, right? I'm not the one who says, this is how we're going to think about this man.
Right.
In order to have that conversation, you have to approach it, first of all, in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
you have to care about the well-being of women in the workplace, which is what this was, and humanity in general. You also have to care about film to have this conversation. However, like I said, I'm not the lawgiver.
Yeah.
And in this realm of the world, there are no laws other than, you know, workplace safety laws, which, had there been any in effect in 1972, he would have violated them.
Sure.
So it comes down to people having to decide if they want to throw out everything he did. And I'm referring now, of course, to the Hannah Gadsby.
I was just thinking Cubism.
Special.
Nanette.
Nanette, where she happily says at the end, yeah, I don't need Picasso. Let history forget Picasso.
Right.
Because of the man he was. Picasso was a horrible person.
Yes, he was.
He was a horrible person. He did terrible things to pretty much every woman in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not my place. It's not my place to say we get rid of Picasso. It's not my place to say we get rid of Roman right. Polanski, Woody Allen.
I was just going to say, a female...
Roman Polanski, who actually raped someone.
Right. No, and a female film critic I know said, look, I'm not giving up Rosemary's Baby.
Right.
But I'm never going to talk about Polanski without mentioning...
Without mentioning this thing.
Yeah. So, like, I'm fine with Bertolucci having an asterisk following him around for the rest of history.
Yeah.
But I'm also not willing to give up on 1900 and, you know, the conformist.
Does that make us hypocrites? If I say the conformist is still an important film and we should watch it.
I think this is an ongoing discussion. I don't know.
You know.
And I wonder also, does it change when they're dead? Is it easier or harder or different to talk about an artist who isn't around anymore and can't answer for anything anymore and can't apologize for anything or atone or whatever.
Right.
And we just have to deal with the art that is left and, like, we either keep it or we toss it, I guess.
Right.
I don't have the answer. I'm not the lawgiver either.
Here's the answer. I still don't know.
Yes.
Because we go round and round and round now about, can you separate the art from the artist?
Right.
And I think for a lot of people it's very difficult to do, and for a lot of people it's pretty easy to do.
Yeah.
And I don't know who's right about that.
Yeah.
I personally, like I said a minute ago, I don't feel the need to go to bat for Bertolucci. If you want to say he's canceled for all of time, I will say, okay.
Yeah, he's not someone I'm going to necessarily fight for. I think there are some films in there, though, that count and that last, yeah. You know. And actually, I don't know that Last Tango is one of them.
It's not. It's not. It was a sensation.
Yeah.
In its moment. And it was a sensation because it was that moment.
Yes.
Because the sexual revolution was in full bloom.
Yeah, and the cinema was embracing different ways of portraying that.
And here was a film that was being really brazen.
Yeah.
About depicting sex on screen and being frank about the kind of sex people have.
That, and also I think integrating the sex into the character and the narrative. Yeah. That they weren't just sort of wedged in for titillation. That the way the characters were interacting had something to do with who they were and what was happening to them.
So it was this sensation of the moment, but was it worth it to do that?
To traumatize Maria Schneider?
To traumatize her for the sake of a film that isn't a film that people talk about very much anymore.
Not really.
It just was this flash, this fire that happened.
But the crazy thing is also, like, it could be that in 25 or 50 years that it is a movie that people start talking about again. Like, you could never predict that sort of thing.
Right.
And ultimately, I think the ultimate what happens is the art is there, whether it's elevated or ignored or forgotten or whatever, long after Bertolucci dies, we die. All the people who are mad at Bertolucci, all the people who want to forgive Bertolucci, all of us die. and the movies are still there, and at some point somebody digs them out and talks about them or doesn't.
There's a great article in the New York Times this week from our wonderful friend,
yes,
Manola Dargis.
I posted a link on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page. Go read this review.
And
this
the article is called, and I'm going to mess the name of the article up, What Films Taught Me About Being a Woman, or
something like that. Yeah.
And it's all about Manola's film watching life.
Yeah.
And the lessons that cinema teaches, that has taught, the lessons that cinema has taught the viewing public about
gender
roles.
Yeah.
And how people interact romantically, sexually, the lessons you have to learn or unlearn from the films you've seen over and over and over again.
Was I having the conversation with you about what did the movies teach you about being gay?
Yes. I will tell you. Here's what the movies taught me about being a young queer person. That it's so sad.
Isn't that sad?
Also, that I will either die of a disease or be murdered.
Yes. Or commit suicide.
Gay pride.
Don't leave that one. Yeah.
That is what the movies have taught me about being gay. The end.
Not all the movies all the time, but when we were young.
Okay, yes,
for sure.
Hashtag not all movies.
No, but I mean, you know.
Sorry. Sorry, sound people. I hit the table. I did not. That was an accident. Yeah, I've been much better about that lately.
You have.
Haven't I? I think I have.
Yes, here's a cookie.
I would like to talk about my DVD pick of the week.
Oh.
Since we're on the subject. I'm going to pull it up here.
Okay.
Where is my thing? Okay. It's the holiday season. So whoop-de-doo
and dickery-dock.
Here come the box sets.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas time, here comes the box sets.
If you have a sleeping bag, if you have a Christmas stocking the size of a sleeping bag, these are stocking stuffers.
Yeah, these are not stocking stuffers. These are box sets. Here's my DVD pick of the week. It just came to our home the other day.
Yes.
Oh, it's so exciting. It's called Pioneers, First Women Filmmakers. It is a six disc set from filmmakers Alice Guy Blaché, Lois Weber, a whole disc of Alice Guy Blaché, a whole disc of Lois Weber. Is Shoes on here? Shoes is not on here, but do y'all remember when I talked about Shoes earlier?
It was your DVD pick a few months ago.
It was a DVD pick. It was a film about a woman who needs new shoes. The way life beats her down for it. It was made in, 1916, 1919? Something like that. Really, really good. Really good movie. A disc three of called Genre Pioneers, disc four. Social Commentary. Oh, Where Are My Children? Which is another great one.
Oh, cool.
From Lois Weber. Yeah, two discs of social commentary films, which is what a lot of the films from these female directors at the time were. We're keeping this. Running time, 1,710 minutes.
Well.
Many, many, many hours.
Of entertainment.
It'll take me...
The rest of your life.
It'll take me a few years to get through all of this.
Probably so.
Yeah. But I'm stoked that we own this now.
The New York Film Critics Circle actually gave a special citation to this box set. And it's important that these early works by women are being preserved and restored. Maria Gates, our friend who works at TCM,
yes,
had an interesting thread on Twitter that I thought is a subject that we don't talk about enough. She was commenting on the fact that the New Beverly Theater's reopening its doors.
Yes, as of yesterday.
In fact, yeah. After being closed for construction and renovation all year. And she pointed out how, you know, the theater's part of its shtick is that it's always on film. Everything is always on 35mm film. That's correct. How Quentin Tarantino has insisted that it be.
Correct.
Which, on the one hand, is great, and it's a boon to film preservation, and probably is encouraging people to create 35mm prints of new movies that otherwise wouldn't exist because everything's all digital now.
Right.
But she also pointed out that for women directors, that a lot of their films haven't been...
They've been lost.
They've been lost, and they right. haven't been considered important enough to preserve. And that's, you know, which also made me think about the Outfest Legacy Project, which is about taking a lot of, you know, LGBT films from over the years, many of which are not owned by major studios and are orphaned in one way or another, and trying to keep those around. And even then, I don't even know, like, when they do restorations, do they always make a 35 print, or do they just do, like, a digital 4K?
I don't know.
You know, but formats matter, and what makes that format matter? And I hadn't really thought about it in that direct term before, and I found that very provocative. So I'm glad this box set exists. I also hope that there are archives, like the George Eastman House or UCLA or whoever, that are striking 35 prints of these films so that they can play in venues like the New Beverly.
Yes. We'll get to your box set
later in the program.
Later. First, let's talk about The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Okay.
It's the new film from Joel and Ethan Coen.
Yep.
It is an omnibus.
An anthology, yes. If you will. Yeah, it's funny because I actually made a mistake. I reviewed it out of Venice when it first premiered, and everything leading up to that, every article about it talked about how we're creating an anthology for Netflix.
Yeah.
And I think everybody thought that meant, oh,
a TV show.
A TV show. Like, right. You're making a series, and every week is going to be a different, like it's Black Mirror or whatever.
Right.
And so, in fact, in my original review, I referred to it as such and had somebody from Netflix be like, no, it's a movie. It's always been a movie. It just, right. You know, it's been called an anthology.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is a series of, what is it, six?
Yes.
Sort of shorts about life in the West, in the Old West.
Specifically in the post-Civil War 19th century.
Fine.
Yes.
The Old West.
Okay. I just want to be clear about when we're talking about.
They said that they were inspired by the sort of European kind of omnibus films where different directors would tackle similar subjects, you know, yeah. Like Spirits of the Dead or,
right.
You know, Europa 66 or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I think, like all anthology films, you know, some are better than others.
Okay, we've got the first one called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Right.
Tim Blake Nelson plays Buster Scruggs. He's a singing cowboy
mm-hmm.
who is also a sharpshooter.
Yes.
He gets into it with some other sharpshooters. I won't tell you how it what happens. Then there's one called Near Algodonis. James Franco
mm-hmm.
Plays a bad dude.
Gets out of one scrape and into another.
Exactly. There's the next one is called Meal Ticket.
Mm, yes.
In which Dudley from Harry Potter plays a limbless
yes.
orator.
Yes. Good description.
And Liam Neeson is his...
Manager?
His manager, carrier, caretaker, because... Harry Melling is the name of the actor. He has no arms or legs. So
the character has no arms.
The character has no arms or legs. And he has to be carted around.
Yes.
From place to place by his manager, caretaker, exploiter,
mm-hmm.
Liam Neeson. And that seems to be going reasonably well until they discover that there is another game in town that people are more interested in laying down their money for.
Right.
There's one called All Gold Canyon, where Tom Waits is a prospector.
Mm-hmm.
Who...
is a prospector played by Tom Waits.
Meets a bad person. The Gal Who Got Rattled stars Zoe Kazan as a young woman on the Oregon Trail.
Mm-hmm.
who meets some misfortune.
And grows close to the wagon master, who is played by Bill Heck, from a Yen Tan film from a few years ago that you might have seen called Pit Stop.
The last one's called The Mortal Remains with Tyne Daly and Saul Rubinek.
Yes, and Brendan Gleeson playing. They are just a handful of the passengers on a stagecoach headed to an uncertain destination.
I think not only are all six of these wonderful, but I think that they are also a coherent collection taken as a whole.
I've heard people say that.
What do you think?
I think there's the for me, what the coherence comes out of the Coens playing with the Western genre, which they did in True Grit.
Right.
But here, like, it feels like they're going after different sub-genres.
Correct.
Here. You know, like, here's our Sergio Leone movie. Here's our John Ford movie. Here is, like, here's some Sam Peckinpah, and here's some, you know, Roy Rogers, you know.
As always, much like in Hail Caesar, they are constantly referencing cinema.
For sure.
While making cinema.
Indeed.
And I have always loved them for that, and I love them for it in this film as well.
I like them a lot, and I've always liked them a lot, and I love them intermittently, but I know for a lot of folks it's they're just ride or die for Coens, and you know, I think they've made some good stuff. I'm not always their giantest fan.
I am more or less ride or die for them. They don't always, you know.
You're not going to defend Intolerable Cruelty or The Lady Killers?
Not really. But I think my favorite... I will tell you my favorite one of the bunch, even though I think they're all terrific.
Uh-huh.
I love Meal Ticket.
Meal Ticket is great.
I love Meal Ticket because of what is his name again? Harry Melling. Dudley from Harry Potter.
Yes.
his face.
All he's got to work with here.
He is Maria Falconetti in this movie.
Google it, kids. And don't get me wrong, there's not one that I don't like.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry.
Was that the end of your sentence?
Yeah, I didn't want to derail your discussion of Meal Ticket. I just wanted to be clear that while I think there's some are better than others, I think they're all good.
And what holds them together is the Coens, obviously very contemporary and very progressive
sensibility,
where, you know, when old Western films were being made, they weren't all necessarily,
oh God,
the wokest of genres.
No.
But this, as a whole, this film is about the bizarre cruelty of American history.
Oh, well, yeah, for sure. It's about the consequences of our westward expansion in a way that a lot of Westerns don't explore it.
It's a film about the torment of indigenous people. It is a film about the whiteness of, you know, most of the terrible things that have happened in American history. the lives of women,
yeah,
in the 19th century, how we viewed marriage back then, the violence of American culture that has been part of the fabric of this country since the beginning.
Oh yeah,
it's about all these things, and they do it very cleverly, sometimes in song.
True. This actor I'd never heard of before named Jonjo O'Neill, who was in On Chesil Beach, which I did not see, pops up in the Stagecoach segment at the end.
Yeah.
And he gives this performance that is so, like, borderline but not overdoing it, and funny 1 second and menacing the next, or I'm like, oh, you're about to be in a lot of Coen Brothers movies. Because you are doing exactly that kind of performance style they really dig. Like, you are going to be sharing the screen with Monk very soon.
Right.
And I will say this. You know, it's funny. Two actresses that I have not the fondest of have proven me wrong this year, or at least impressed me this year in a way they haven't before. Carey Mulligan in Wildlife and Zoe Kazan in this film.
Yeah. Yeah. I have not paid much attention to Zoe Kazan. Honestly. I know she's in things, and I see the things sometimes.
Well, she was in Big Sick, you know.
I was not the boss of King Sick. The boss of King Sick. I was not the boss of the Big Sick.
Me neither.
I was not the greatest champion of that film.
Nor I.
It was
fine.
It was very good.
Yes. There were aspects of it that were
kind of all I thought about it.
Yeah, like Holly Hunter and Ray Romano were great.
Correct. Anyway, I get her a little more now.
Yeah.
I want to see her more.
Fair enough.
After this.
You know, and this is the conversation that is going to be coming up now for a lot of these Netflix movies is, like, you know, how does it work on the small screen, excuse me, versus the big screen? And I'm glad that I got to see it projected, because particularly the Tom Waits segment.
Yes.
I think the Coens have never shot the outdoors with as much grandeur as they do in that sequence.
You kind of have to. It's a Western.
Sure. Yeah. But I'm just saying, like,
that's part of being a Western.
It absolutely. But it just, you know, it's something new in their wheelhouse, you know. Even when they made True Grit, I don't think they ever really did the big sky country the way they do in the Tom Waits segment.
I might disagree with you on that, but continue.
Anyway, so I'm glad that I got to see it projected, but, you know, you watched it on Netflix.
I did.
And it was fine.
Right here on the couch, wrapped up in my flannel robe. It was a pretty good way to watch it. That might end up being how I see Roma, too, if I can't get out to one of the three utterly sold-out screenings that are taking place here in Los Angeles.
Right. Well, or we can hopefully maybe
10 o'clock in the morning. Oh, I'm sorry. It's sold out.
Or,
it's 10 o'clock.
Or work our way into an award screening or something. I really want you to see that on the big screen.
So anyway, it's on Netflix, you guys, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Why don't you watch that? Why don't you skip Anna in the Apocalypse? That's what you probably ought to do. Oh, wait, does Alonso Duralde, El Mero Mero de Navidad, disagree with me?
Yes, but why don't you go first?
Because describe what happens.
You always like to make me go first when we disagree about something so that you can sort of swoop in.
Describe what happens, and then I will tell. Then I'll go first on opinionizing.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Anna is a high school senior in Scotland. Her mother is dead. Her father works as a janitor in the school. He is upset to learn that her plans are not to go on to university, but to go to Australia. She wants to travel around for a while before getting back into her education. It is almost Christmas, and everyone in her school is getting ready for the holiday and for the school talent show that's happening that night. She has an ex floating around who she can't seem to quite get rid of.
He's literally floating around in the air like a balloon.
No, he's around. And she has a best friend who is in love with her, but she either doesn't notice or is just not interested in seeing him that way. And then there's a zombie outbreak.
Right.
And it's Christmas time.
Yep.
And it's a musical.
Yes.
That's what happens in Anna and the Apocalypse.
How does she kill those zombies?
In various different ways. Often with
what's the best way?
Often with a spiky candy cane.
That's correct.
Although she does also behead one with a teeter totter.
True. That's also true.
Yes.
All right. Here's what I like about it. It is by necessity, due to its budget, pretty scrappy. It understands what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And tries hard to be like Shaun of the Dead in terms of its, you know, cheeky, you know, sense of humor and, you know, the juxtaposition of the end of the world with what is meant to be, you know, the most
comedy.
Wonderful time of the year.
That too.
That is also a musical comedy with gore and brain-eating zombies that get their heads blown off.
Do they brain eat or do they just bite?
I don't remember.
I think they mainly just bite.
All right. This needed about 30 more minutes in the oven. And I don't mean 30 more minutes of running time, because then I would have wanted to kill myself as a zombie. It's not funny enough. It's not gory enough. The songs are not good. There is one cool musical number that takes place in a cafeteria where everyone is singing and dancing and there's choreography and it feels like the beginning of La La Land in a way, but not as extravagant as
right.
that. That was a
very
monumental, elaborate thing. But almost, not all of them, but almost every song is a roadblock. It's an opportunity for the film to come to a dead halt so that we can learn about the inner turmoil or the whatever the inner monologue is of some teenager. None of whom are really fleshed out very well as characters, save for Anna, but even she has just a few personality points that they hang her entire character on. I wished for more creative deaths along the lines of the candy cane spike.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's the big main prop that they're using to sell the film.
Right.
Right? It's just an object. It's not utilized to its fullest potential as a comedy weapon.
Hmm.
And I found myself very wrung out by the end of it because I was overcome with disappointment.
Hmm.
Wishing that I had seen the thing that I was hoping I was going to see.
Sure.
The thing that you... I'm going to lay a little blame at your doorstep here. You came home from the first press screening. You have seen it twice.
Yes.
At this point, because you took me to the second press screening.
Yes.
You came home from the first press screening just rubbing your little hands together and telling me how great it was. And so I'm stoked, right? I walk in, and I'm ready, and I'm like, this is going to be great, because Alonso says it's great. And then I just kept sitting there, wondering when it was going to get great.
Maybe I shouldn't have said anything.
Maybe not.
All right. I will agree with you that the horror aspects are the least fulfilling.
Right.
They're also the ones I'm least interested in, so that probably is, you know, okay. I'm sure that helps.
Right.
But yeah, it's not scary, and it's not as gory as it certainly could have been if they had felt like going that way. But I think also they probably felt like they were going to lose the musical people if they got too gross with it, maybe.
Well, you got to make a movie that's good enough to get to satisfy everyone.
No, you're
who
right.
Comes to your genre film.
I see your point.
Yeah.
I disagree with you about the songs. I don't think they're all great, but I think there are several of them that are quite good, and that all are right. catchy that I will be thinking about. I disagree with you about the characters. I found them to be interesting and charming, and I thought there was a lot of fun interplay between them, between, you know, Anna and the best friend, between the sort of, you know, I liked the lesbian newspaper editor girl who's like, you know, super committed to causes, and every time she tries to be funny, it's like really awkward and it just kind of falls flat.
Right.
You know, I thought the ex who winds up sort of like coming into his own as a zombie killer, you know, had some moments that were interesting. I could have done without like the headmaster. I thought he was a bit overdone, but from what I understand, this guy's whole career is built on too much.
I see.
But you know, I liked how they worked in the Christmas stuff. I liked how they integrated the songs into, you know, what was also a zombie movie. And you know, I agree with you. It is scrappy. It's scruffy. It's a low budget movie. And I think what we are able to forgive in a low budget horror movie, it's harder to forgive with a low budget musical, because musicals we expect more, you know, more of an extravaganza. But I liked its attitude, and I thought it was fun, and I'm glad I saw it, and I will, you know, I will come back to it in future, you know, at future Christmases.
I will never.
Fine.
Yeah.
I'll watch it after you go to bed.
Why don't you talk about your DVD pick of the week while I put dinner into the oven?
Sure. Okay. So we were talking before about it's box set season. So in addition to the Pioneer Women Filmmakers box from Kino, the Criterion Collection has just put out the Bergman box to celebrate the centenary of Ingmar Bergman, and it is a doozy. Also, you know, I'm sure thousands of minutes of entertainment, you know, something like 18 features, a whole bunch of commentaries, interviews with Bergman, interviews with, you know, his key collaborators, a 248-page booklet that comes with it. You know, it is, if you have a cineast in your life, this is definitely something they'll be thrilled to see under the tree. And it's just a very exhaustive and expansive set devoted to one of the, you know, 20th century's most important filmmakers. And so, yeah, letters, please.
I has them.
Mm-hmm.
Zach asks, well, he says, love listening to the podcast as a film enthusiast.
Thanks.
I would love to know how you created your own blog, the Linoleum Knife page. I'm interested to know, as I would love to publish my own reviews, yet would also love to hear from two professionals. Keep up the good work.
Well, thankfully, we have a friend of ours who volunteered to make our page, yes, for us, because we're clueless.
Thank you, Andy.
For that kind of thing. Andy, you're awesome. You know, I would say, though, if you hop onto WordPress, there are plenty of sites. I think, what, medium.com, right, allows you to create your own blog. There are any number of websites that will just sort of, like, you know, do their best to make it super simple for you to get on there and start posting stuff. And you know, once you start using it, you can kind of dig into figuring out, like, how do you format your page to make it look different? And how do you add different graphic stuff and pictures and yada-da?
Every time I go on YouTube, Carly Kloss is trying to tell me how to set up my own webpage.
Well, there you go.
So I never listened to her.
You know, I think if you want to join...
Maybe you could.
You know, if you want to sign up with Squarespace, I know that's a thing that where they, like, show you how to create your own website and stuff.
Right.
So there's, you know, we're idiots, and thankfully people hold our hands and take care of us. But, you know, if you want to just hop into these stuff, there's plenty of places on the web that will accommodate you and let you create a place to publish your stuff. So do it. Make it happen.
Yeah. I have nothing to add to this. You start up, I mean, go to Carly Kloss. She's trying to help you to make your own page.
Who's Carly Kloss?
What do you mean, who's Carly Kloss?
I mean, who's Carly Kloss?
What country do you live in?
I like to be in America. Who's Carly Kloss?
Only one of the young model girls of the fashion industry.
Oh, okay.
Famous spokesperson for building your own webpage.
Well, I rely on you to let me know about these things, and since I've never heard you mention the name Carly Kloss until now,
I didn't think I had to.
Falling down on the job.
Why should I have to mention her to you when you should already know
who
she is?
You know that I need flashcards.
This next letter is from Michael... Michael. I'm a relatively new listener, and I started listening at the beginning of the summer. As I listened to your great chemistry, the thought that went through my head was, wow, these two should date. I ship them. I thought this for, not even kidding, like 3 or 4 weeks. Even though in the beginning of almost every podcast, you guys say that you are married. In your defense, we don't say it at the beginning of
every episode.
Just sometimes we don't, and sometimes we do. It's sort of like, for a long time, we didn't at all because we didn't think it was information that anyone cared about.
Right.
But then over the years, we got to know that people did care about that information.
It was germane after all.
Yeah, it was part of the reason some people kept listening.
Right.
And so now sometimes we remember to say it and sometimes we don't. Anyway, okay, continuing with the letter. I guess this was my undiagnosed ADD kicking in until one day I finally listened and realized that you two are in fact married. I remember in that moment that I was filled with joy because for weeks in my head I was secretly rooting for you two to get together.
Well done. You made it happen, Michael.
I guess it all works out in the end. We have been make-out buddies for like 23 years.
It's true.
Yeah. And now legally.
Yes. In all 50 states.
Anyway, that was just a side note. The real reason I'm writing this letter is because a few episodes ago, I think it was the one that you guys took like a 3-hour break and then came back and finished the recording, Dave mentioned that it was almost his bedtime at 8:30 p.m. Sorry, let me spit that out without laughing. It was almost his bedtime at 8:30 p.m. I have never related to someone on any other level before he said that, not even my girlfriend. I feel like I have said everything I have to say for now. Next time you two are in New York, let a Long Island guy know I have to get you two a beer or some tea. Why not both? I'm good. Listen, if it's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you can get me some tea. Then you can get me some dinner, during which I will drink the beer. I contain so many food items at various times of the day.
Not to mention at once.
Dinner should be no later than 6 p.m. so that I can go to bed at
8:30.
I'm just giving you up my itinerary now.
I don't think I've ever been to Long Island.
I've never been to Long Island.
I know a lot of people from there. But
I've been to Manhattan.
Me too.
I've been to Brooklyn.
Ditto.
I've been to Queens.
I've been to Queens.
It's delightful. Queens is lovely.
I'm sure it is.
Say something about Brooklyn.
What's that?
Well, over the past several months, I've been trying to get everybody all caught up with all the things they need. I'm talking about all you Patreon people.
Yes.
Now, if you go to patreon.com/linoleumknife, you'll understand what I'm talking about. But it's a situation where you can subscribe to our extra content, extra audio and digital content. There's a podcast about TV. There's a podcast about food. There's a podcast about religion, politics, and all the things that, you know,
we tend not to talk about here.
Well, no, we do tend to talk about those things here, but we talk about them much more,
I suppose,
on that show. And also, we are using our everyday cuss words.
Yes, which we do not use on the show.
Which we do not use on this show. Anyway, everybody who is a Patreon member gets something. Mm-hmm. Like the people at the $4 level and the $7 level, they get little Linoleum Knife stickers in the mail, and I've been trying to get those out. And the people at the higher levels get prizes, items, objects, and I'm you know, doing it every day. I'm doing it. Some folks haven't been caught up in a while, and to catch them up. But I'm pretty much, I see the light at the end of the tunnel.
All right.
And I have something to report.
We have a lot of listeners in Brooklyn?
So many. Like, I think we have more people listening to us in Brooklyn than in Los Angeles.
Crazy.
Every 10th thing I send out is going to Brooklyn.
Hmm.
What is that about?
Those are our people. I guess now we know if we ever do a live show, that's
where we have to go to Brooklyn to do it.
Yeah. And hey, unpaid advertisement, if you're in Brooklyn, go to Hinterland's Bar. It's great.
What's in Hinterland's Bar?
That's Stuart Wellington's bar.
Oh, from the Flophouse.
Yes.
Yes. You went there.
With Gary this summer.
With Gary, got it, yeah. Anyway, thank you, Michael, for bringing us together, for causing our marriage.
Yes, it's all on you and your magic.
Last letter, Catherine. Oh, this is a long one.
Yeah.
All right, let's get it going, and then we're done. A big hello. I love listening to the podcast on my commute to work in rainy weather. And when I'm at work at the least visited high-end homeware shop... Oh, I'm sorry. When I am at work at the least visited high-end homeware shop in all of the British Isles, I found you both from the Pop Rocket podcast...
Yay!
...where all excellence is found. And I fell in love with the way Dave spoke about the Momofuku Milk Bar cookbook, which I immediately purchased. On the most recent podcast, you spoke about people sending you their top 10 favorite films, and I thought this would be a great exercise in being told that my taste is awful by people I consider to have nearly perfect opinions.
Oh, golly.
So here we go. Catherine, we're going to knife your list.
Yes.
At the end of this list, we will tell you how knife your list is, and by extension, how knife you are. Number 10, View from the Top.
Oh, dear Lord.
She says you can stop right now if you'd like.
Is this a hint of things to come?
But on the understanding that a favorite film doesn't necessarily have to be any good.
Well, indeed.
This has beat out Sweet Home Alabama to the top 10 club. Gwyneth is a car crash of white privilege, but this great bad film is one I can watch from start to finish and be entertained every time. No one in this film is doing their best work, but in an impressionistic mess, they have rendered entertainment.
That's the Gwyneth as a stewardess movie, in case people have forgotten.
Sorry,
about it.
Impressionist-esque is what I meant to read.
Okay.
Number 9, BBC Arena Screen Goddesses. I don't think I know what this is.
Arena is a show. Like, it's like a documentary. It's like every week it's a documentary about a different topic.
She says, the Arena documentaries are hit and miss by their nature, as they are all made by different people at different stages of their career. But this is a truly great documentary. It is about the golden age of cinema and how the actresses involved from the silent film era onwards held all the cards. It is sleepy and hypnotic in style, but will make you power Google when you're finished. It whets your appetite about brilliant, interesting women.
Hmm.
And number 8, here's one we can all agree on. Josie and the Pussycats.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something that I love about that if you want to hear the music, the great music from this film, you have to watch the film. You cannot buy or stream the soundtrack anywhere. It is my personal secondhand music shop holy grail. Honey, we'll send you a copy.
I was going to say, it's very easy to find in the United States.
You know what? It maybe was never released.
In the UK.
Yeah.
They even put it out on vinyl last year for the film's anniversary.
Let's find her a copy.
Yes.
Okay.
Let us know where to send that.
Do you have a compact disc player? Because that's how you can buy it.
Yes.
In the United States. For about a dollar.
Probably, yeah.
Frankly, yeah. This is perfect Tara Reid. Iconic. Mm. I agree with you. It's the film that made me realize forever that I will never forsake her. My Tara Reid. Parker Posey, who will come up again, and Rachel Lee Cook, mid-hype. It's when you know you know. It is a when you know film that will misguidedly make friends with anyone. I will misguidedly make friends with anyone who likes it.
It's a great movie. And by the way, folks, if you ever want to hear our commentary track episode about it, Google Josie and the Pussycats Linoleum Knife, and it'll tell you how to order it.
Tabloid, another documentary, but a horse of a completely different color. If this is on BBC iPlayer, I will stop what I am doing and sit for it. A truly weird documentary these days.
Errol Morris.
And that it has the firsthand story of everyone involved and doesn't seem to have a viewpoint. Considering that the outcome of any decision made by the film is relatively low stakes, means that you are absolutely left to make up your own mind.
Okay.
Number 5, Legally Blonde. The peak of the white blonde young woman films of its time. It's a wonderful movie.
It is.
Yeah. underrated and by far the film I quote the most in real life. Out of anything on this list, I care the least if you make fun of me for it. I will fight for this film as a modern classic, a stunning fantasy that a man who sexually harasses in the workplace gets his comeuppance.
Well, it's funny, we've had this this letter sitting around for a while, and it's sheer coincidence that we're reading it on the week that Ariana Grande's Thank You Next video came out.
Yes, and why is John Cantwell not in this video?
I have to ask myself.
Our friend, you guys, our friend John Cantwell is a sometime actor who was the Queenie dude in the hair salon in Legally Blonde who does the bend and snap.
You did the punchline.
Yes.
Oh, you're doing the bend and snap.
Yeah. That's...
That should be his entree into this Ariana Grande
video. Why is he not in this Ariana Grande video?
Harumph.
That's my only beef with that Ariana Grande video. Mm. Otherwise, it's spectacular. Bend it like Beckham.
Okay.
It is a testament to the casting of this film that we immediately shipped Keira Knightley, Parminder Nagra, and Archie Punjabi off to America to be real famous people. I was in the Southampton Saints British Premier League team, girls under the tens team, and this was my ultimate dream. I loved Parminder Nagra in this and only ever watch ER for her. A perfect tightrope of showing how coming from a religious family that may be restrictive does not necessarily make that religion or that family bad. 3. The Wizard of Oz. Every Boxing Day since I was 8 years old, you guys in the United States, Boxing Day is December 26th.
Yes.
And it's when everyone jumps into a ring and boxes.
And it's the day they re-gift everything they didn't want on Christmas in a new box.
I've gotten up very, very early and watched The Wizard of Oz. It is obviously a good film, but I know plenty of films that you can say that about that are not repeatable in the way Oz is. It's one of the greatest films of all time. It is one of the greatest films of all time.
I'll say it's one of the most influential films
of all time. It is one of the greatest films of all time.
Very well.
It was my first Judy Garland. I had a copy of it on VHS that had a documentary about how it was made that immediately followed the credits, and it was my main source of trivia as a child. I was incredibly one note. Little Shop of Horrors. From the opening number to Suddenly Seymour to the beautiful mess of the end, this is a perfect musical. Being a 90s baby, only just, this was my first taste of Steve Martin, and I was hooked. I was easily too young to see it when I did, and I love it all the more. Number 1, Caramel, which I have not seen.
Don't know it.
This was on BBC Two when I first found it, but I have 2 copies of it now, just in case. It is objectively beautiful, but not unrealistic, a romantic comedy about 4 women who work in a beauty salon in post-Civil War Beirut. It sounds great. The mix of Arabic and French that the women speak is soft and gorgeous. These women are universally recognizable without being stereotypical. The things that they experience are relatable without losing the culture that has caused some of their situations. The opening title sequence is just women eating caramel. I was immediately on board. This list really dates me. I was born in 1990, and I think these really show that. Feel absolutely free to tell me that I am wrong and dumb, as Dave has threatened. I hope you both have a wonderful week. I will be signing up for Patreon on payday at the end of the month. Thank you for your podcasting, Catherine.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you, Catherine. Well, let's knife this list. Okay. All right. We haven't seen Caramel, so she gets that one.
Yes.
Benefit of the doubt.
Free and clear.
Little Shop of Horrors?
Definitely.
Yes. I have personally eaten a beef Wellington.
Made by Ellen Green.
Prepared by Ellen Green herself.
Yes.
I had to name drop that because you should never know that if you're in the same kitchen with her, she might make you a beef Wellington.
You never know.
And it will be delicious.
Yes, it will.
Number 3, The Wizard of Oz. Yes, she sure gets that. Number 4, Bend It Like Beckham.
Yeah.
Bend It Like Beckham.
Yes.
In other news, you also gave us Beckham.
Yes, this is true.
And his charming wife. They are the best people of Los Angeles.
Are they still here?
They are the most Los Angeles of Los Angeles people that you could ever Los Angeles.
Are they still here?
They better be.
They didn't go back to London after... Is he still playing for the Galaxy? I don't know
who he's playing for.
I don't know that they live here still.
Well, I'm hoping that they do.
Okay.
What would Los Angeles be without Vicky Bex?
It might be what it is right now, because we don't even know if she lives here anymore.
I can't stand to think about that. Number five, Legally Blonde. Yeah, you get that too.
Absolutely.
Number six, Tabloid. You get that one.
Yeah, not my favorite, but it's okay.
Oh, you know which one I skipped accidentally?
What?
The First Wives Club. Here's the description. My partner rolls their eyes when I press play on this. I recite the words to this film as it is happening. Yes, I am indeed the worst. Bette Midler in this film is who I want to be when I grow up. When I was 13, I would put on the pearls I inherited from my Nana and do the speech she does in the meat freezer with her in my living room.
I
hate that movie.
I would rather see that performance than that movie again.
I hate that movie, but I'm going to give it to you because of your love for it. And
all right, fine.
Josie and the Pussycats is...
Done.
We got to give you number nine, the BBC Arena Screen Goddesses, because we've never
seen it.
View from the Top, no.
Oh, hell no.
No. But guess what? That makes you still 90% knife, Catherine.
Yeah. Well done.
And if you're going to wait until January 1st...
This is an old email. She might be a patron for all I know.
Well, I better get her stuff out to her, hadn't I?
I guess you should.
She's probably at the end of my queue waiting to be paid attention to. Anyway, if you sign up in January, there's going to be a new level of subscription.
Yes, more on that later.
An even cheaper one than $4.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll still get a thing. Oh, we have so many plans for you.
All right.
We're finished.
We are. Hey, everybody. Patreon is a thing, and you should go check it out at patreon.com/linoleumknife and get those extra episodes, get the awesome prizes, all those things, and, you know, just help keep this whole crap game afloat. Hi, Pilar. We're taping. Okay.
Taping. That's so funny.
We're recording.
Our niece, Pilar,
fine.
Just walked in the front door.
Slammed that door.
She's here to eat some dinner.
Okay.
And she has a very
right.
large painting.
All right. Let me... I'm trying...
I didn't want to leave it in my car.
That makes total sense. Okay. Let me finish this episode, please.
Hang on. There's one more thing.
What?
Would you like to buy a linoleum knife t-shirt?
Oh, sure you would.
I have some sizes left. Why don't you email me? At dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. That is D. Leland, LELAND. That's my middle name. White, dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. They are $22 if you live in the United States. They are more if you live in other countries. Because, y'all, that postage is crazy.
So if you ask about sizes.
They're 100% cotton. They're black. They say linoleum knife across the chest. And we have some sizes left.
Yes.
Not all, so you must email me first and talk to me about the size you need. We have women's sizes. We have men's sizes.
And find out. And if you aren't in the U.S., let us know where you are so we know how much extra to add for that postage.
Yep.
Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com, which is where you can hear the What the Flick podcast. Listen to Bibbs and Whitney on Cancel Too Soon and on their Schmoes Know podcast, critically acclaimed. Check out... Dennis Henry with Dennis Hensley and All Things Cozy, which Dave was just on and I will be on soon. And, of course, The Comics Canon and Sewers of Paris, The Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Super Gay, and Secretly Timid. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Go check out all of his action at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. You can subscribe to this program for free at Apple Podcasts, where you should leave us a 5-star review, because that would be awesome of you. And you can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean and Stitcher Radio and Lounge.com. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. And again, I am on the Deck the Hallmark podcast this week. Had a lovely time talking to those guys. And I will have other announcements coming up soon of other shows that I'm on talking about Christmas movies. You'll be so sick of me by the end of the month. It's not even funny. Anyway, y'all are awesome. Thanks for listening. We'll be around next time for more. So until then,
goodbye.